Welcome back to the Mindful Hunter Podcast. I'm your host, as always, Jay Nickel. We have a pretty interesting episode today, and it's a little bit of a departure from our regular content. And I wouldn't say it's a drastic departure, but it's not directly related to hunting, but I think the topic area and the kind of tools that I'm going to discuss can be directly applied to hunting and other things you may be dealing with. So the episode is going to be titled something along the lines of how to identify your unique competitive advantage and execute transitions in life. I think this is one of the things I've had like the steepest learning curve with in life, and also probably more to do with my business background than anything else, learned the most about in the last 6 to 7 years. And this recent experience I had with the bodybuilding show really highlighted the need to assess and make plans in regards to both of these items. Recognizing your, and you could call this something as simple as recognizing your strengths. The reason I prefer competitive advantage, we'll get into it in a little more detail, but it's a more fulsome term. Like, you could be strong at something, and if everybody else is even stronger at that thing, then relatively speaking, it doesn't really matter. Whereas competitive advantage does a better job of encapsulating something that gives you a unique advantage over other people. As far as the transitions go, early on in my life, I was terrible at transitions, whether it was from relationships, jobs, hobbies. I was always good at figuring things out on the fly, so I would just wait until something was about to blow up, and then I would just jump ship and go do something else and figure it out while I landed. And you can get away with that in your 20s when you're single, but when you are raising a family and have mortgage payments and all the rest, you need to have a better plan and be more responsible about your transitions, or you need to just suck it up and keep doing the same shit that you don't want to be doing. And that's not an outcome that's acceptable to me, which means I need to have a better plan. So that's what we're going to dive into today. Now, before we get into that, I want to give an update on the bodybuilding show, because that's kind of the springboard for this whole conversation that we're going to have. So I'll keep it rather short. I couldn't have asked for anything else. It was a phenomenal show. I had a great time. Everything went to plan. There were no big mistakes. Posing was great. The organization of the show was great, except for the evening part, but we can dive into that more later. It's not really a big deal. My peak went great. I placed 7th out of 13 guys in both of my divisions. Now, if you don't understand bodybuilding, that doesn't seem particularly good. And I mean, it's not great whether you understand bodybuilding or not. The reason that it's decent in bodybuilding is that there's a thing called the first call out in bodybuilding. And the first call out is that first group of guys. So if they bring 14, 15 guys on stage, they'll take a look at the top 5 or the top 6. You come out and do an individual presentation round first, and they get a chance to look at everybody independently. And through those presentation rounds, the judges pick their top 5 or 6 and then bring them back. And then everybody goes back up on stage, and those first 5 or 6 go up first for comparisons. And that's called the first call out. The fact that I landed 7th and I was only 1 point away from 6th in one of my classes means that, because they were both 6-person callouts in those divisions, I was only 1 person away from the first callout. And getting into the first callout in a big show is a big deal. The dudes in my division were absolutely enormous. The guys who were in my bodybuilding division, there was a guy who weighed over 280 pounds, ripped on stage. Like, you were looking at these guys and you were just like, this is crazy. And in the classic physique division, now there's a weight cap, so they can't be too big, but it really highlighted to me how much your bone structure plays a role. Like, I'm just a heavy dude. I'm thick and heavy. I have dense bones. And I was talking to another guy. We were both 215 pounds, and he just looked enormous compared to me. Now, none of this is excuse making or anything. I feel great. Like the fact that I could stand toe to toe those guys. And here's the deal. Structure and muscularity has a lot to do with genetics. Conditioning is more determined by effort and hard work. Now, one could make an argument that the mental capacity required for that hard work is also kind of genetically derived, which I do believe it plays a significant role. But what kept me placing so high was my conditioning, which means that the thing and my posing, which means that the two items that were under my control that I could have more of an impact on, I executed to the best of my ability. And last year, I was not happy with my conditioning and I was not happy with my posing. So for the fact that I was able to bring those two things, you know, forward and improve them both meant a lot to me. I'll get into more about my future plans later on. I just want to focus on the actual show. It's such a trip, man. Like going up on stage in front of all those people and all the lights, and you practice and you practice and you practice, and then to have it, to nail it in front of everybody with people who are significantly better than you are, and to be able to hold your own in classes like that, I can't express how positive a feeling that is. And I think before we dive any further, if there's, I don't care if it's a half marathon, I don't care if it's a photo shoot for your wife, if there's something that you can put on the calendar that challenges you, that's going to cause you to rise to the occasion, I recommend doing it. Because I'm a deadline kind of guy. I need something real taking place in the future in order to cement my commitment to stuff. I'm not the type of guy to just lose 10 pounds to lose 10 pounds. I need some type of goal. And I can say that planning this show and planning to compete in this show definitely caused me to rise to my best version of myself. And I'm super grateful. Struggling a little bit with quitting now, given how close I was to the first call out. I put on 5 pounds of stage weight last year, which is very impressive being 44 years old. People see all these hype and claims about people adding 10, 20, 30 pounds of muscle. It's bullshit. You know, an average professional bodybuilder who is probably one of the most elite genetic individuals on the planet, once they're in their pro status, might put on like 7 to 8 pounds would be outstanding. Now, yes, earlier on in their career, when guys first hop on gear, yeah, you can put on 20, 25 pounds in a year for sure. Maybe once, maybe twice, but the odds are low. Once you get a mature physique, being able to put on 5 to 8 pounds takes an extraordinary amount of work. So the fact that I was able to put on 5 pounds, and the fact that I know if I dedicated another year of my life to this, I could put on another 5 pounds, and I would then be big enough to be in that first call out, given the conditioning that I'm now capable of achieving, is making it psychologically challenging to walk away. I'm having problems. But, and that's part of what we're going to talk about here today, that doesn't matter. I made a plan. I made a commitment. I gave my word to my wife and my daughter that this was my last show. And it's my last show. Now, listen, I'm 44 and I kind of made a joke to my wife the other night. Maybe I'll do a comeback when I'm 50 and I'm in the first year of the 50 plus division. And sure, maybe I would do something like that a few years down the road when my daughter's older, when things have calmed down around the house, when Mindful Hunter and Mindful Reviews are more stable and they've grown more, definitely. But for the next few years, while I need to focus on the things I need to focus on, I will not be competing in bodybuilding. I'll still be training. I'll still be eating healthy. I'll still be pushing myself to my limits, but I will not be competing. It just takes too much energy and focus away from the other things that matter. Now, I think that's an excellent point to transition, because the statement that I just made was it takes too much energy and focus away from the things that matter. So question number one, well, why doesn't bodybuilding matter? And that leads you to question number two, if something else does matter, how do you know it matters? And that is what we're here to talk about today. How can we approach this decision-making in a kind of structured manner and objectively find out where we should be putting our energy? Now, I like frameworks. Frameworks give us a way to organize our thinking and assess different potential outcomes with a certain amount of objectivity. Without a framework, you're just randomly thinking about something and most likely you're going to be led by emotion. One of the very interesting things about human beings, and this comes from the work I do in my day job, is that we think we make decisions cognitively and then reinforce them emotionally. So when you're buying a new car, you convince yourself that you let due diligence and research lead your choice. In fact, when they run tests on people pre and post purchases, what actually happens is we make these decisions emotionally and then we rationalize them cognitively. So we will feel a certain emotional attachment to some type of purchase. We know it's going to make us feel good to buy it. We will then go seek out information that supports that purchase so that we can rationalize our emotional decision cognitively with a certain amount of logic. So it's not the other way around. And by implementing some type of structured decision-making through the application of frameworks, we can wrangle our emotions and let our mind and data lead the decision-making process. So the first thing I want to talk about is competitive advantage. What is a competitive advantage? There's even a more concrete term called sustainable competitive advantage, but we don't need to get into it. And we're going to kind of cross the bridge into business terminology here. So competitive advantage was originally proposed by an individual named Michael Porter. Now, Michael Porter was a professor at Harvard. He also started a consulting group called the Monitor Group, went on to be one of the biggest management consulting groups in the world. It was very big, very powerful for a long time. Then there was a merger or something and it kind of got swallowed up by another one. It's not really such a big player anymore. But think of like McKinsey, Boston Consulting Group, Bain & Co. Like Monitor was right up there with those. Now, what Porter did was he defined competitive advantage. So what he said is that competitive advantage refers to the unique qualities, assets, or strategies that allow a business or organization to outperform its competitors in the market. Now, it can take various forms and it can arise from different sources, but I want you to think about it very simply. It's something that you are particularly good at, that your competitors are not particularly good at, and that people would find hard to copy. So there has to be some unique ability that you have that other people don't have. And it doesn't have to be perfect, and there can be other people with similar strengths, but if we were going to look at it globally, by you possessing these traits and characteristics, it puts you in a small enough group that's more successful at these particular, you know, traits and skills and characteristics than most other people. I'm not saying you have to be the only one in the world who can do this. But like, you know, Walmart, for example, their competitive advantage is, well, one is their buying power, but another one is their supply chain. They have this incredibly complicated supply chain logistics on-demand management software that enables them to manage massive levels of inventory way more successfully than almost anybody else on the planet. Now, there are other companies whose competitive advantage is also supply chain. So it's not like Walmart can be the only one in the world to do it, but they need to be significantly better than their competitors at it. Now, before I get into different types of competitive advantage, Warren Buffett uses another way to describe competitive advantage, and he coined the term moat. So the moat refers to a sustainable and durable barrier that protects a company's market position. So Buffett, when he invests in companies, He wants them to have a moat. Now, a moat would be a thing that's around the company that protects the company. It's something that other companies can't do well. So I'm basically just providing you two models or two perspectives to look at the exact same thing. Buffett prefers to look at it as more of a barrier that protects the company, whereas Porter looks at it more as a set of unique skills or resources that give you some type of edge over your competition. So if by thinking about it either way is easier for you, it doesn't matter. They're the same things. So let's take a look. Now, this is in business, okay? We'll get into personal competitive advantage later on. But, you know, here's some examples of competitive advantage. Cost advantage. This occurs when a company is able to produce goods or services at a lower cost than its competitors. You know, a really good example would have been, you know, the iPhone when it first went over to China due to the contracts that Jobs was able to negotiate. They were producing at such a scale that they could produce significantly cheaper than other people. Differentiation. So differentiation involves creating a unique and valued product or service that stands out in the market. Again, here, I think the iPhone is a fantastic example. When you go, I don't know if anybody's watched the new BlackBerry movie. I watched it on the flight home. It is fantastic. But it did a great job of showing you just how disruptive the iPhone was when it first launched. There was nothing on the planet that even remotely resembled an iPhone. And it was so far ahead technologically from other products that no one had a hope of competing. Now, that competitive advantage did erode over time. And that's what I'm talking about. Like, the moat is not always perfect. And the sustainable part of the competitive advantage is not always perfect. And in fact, a great example of that would be BlackBerry itself. BlackBerry had a technological or innovative competitive advantage. But because they didn't innovate aggressively enough, they lost that competitive advantage and they were supplanted by the iPhone. Access to resources can be another competitive advantage. Maybe you have, you know, this is a great hunting one. Maybe you've got some private land. That's a competitive advantage. Maybe you own a ranch that's 40,000 acres and nobody else is allowed to hunt on that. When it comes to hunting, you have a sustainable competitive advantage. Market focus. So concentrating on a specific market segment or niche can lead to a competitive advantage. An example of this is what I ended up doing with Mindful Reviews. I will get into the story of Mindful Reviews in more detail later on, but I've been doing Mindful Hunter for almost 7 years now. I've made hundreds of videos. I've made workout videos. I've made cooking videos. I've made how to make your own supplement videos. I've made filming videos. I've probably made videos that would fall into 10 or 15 different categories that were all mildly interesting to different groups of people. When I did the 5 backpack review and it kind of blew up, I realized that there was a unique ability. There was a market, a specific niche market of individuals of a certain age group, of a certain income potential, who had a very deep interest in learning about gear in a very technical way, who would watch a 2-hour backpack gear review. That's a market focus. I'm not saying I'm the only guy doing that, but there's not that many other. And I would argue there isn't any that are doing it as well as I am. And I still got a long way to go until I'm making the content that I know I'm capable of. But my ability to focus on that market while other people are not focused on that market is a competitive advantage. Listen, there's more examples of competitive advantage and I could go on and on about it the all day. But the important part to recognize is that it is a unique set of skills, resources, or characteristics that the majority of your competition doesn't possess that give you a unique ability to be more successful than them in some way, shape, or form. Now that's identifying it. Now maintaining it over the long term is a completely different conversation, which if enough people are interested, we can do that. This is one of the things I help businesses with, like Lululemon, Adidas, Arc'teryx, hospitals, banks, insurance companies. How do they maintain the competitive advantage that gave them the market share that they now have? So now that we know what competitive advantage is, how would we go about identifying what our own unique competitive advantage is? So the next concept or framework that I want to introduce is the hedgehog concept. This is a guy by a management expert named Jim Collins. He wrote the book From Good to Great. And if you think about three overlapping circles, like a Venn diagram, where those three circles overlap in the middle, almost forms this little like oblong triangle that kind of looks like you're looking from the top down onto a hedgehog, which is why it's called the hedgehog concept. Now, one circle represents what you are deeply passionate about. Another circle represents what you can be the best in the world at. And the third circle represents what drives your economic engine. And if you walk through this exercise and you just Google the hedgehog concept, and there'll be all kinds of like little Q&A sheets and little exercises that will help lead you through answering these questions. Okay, so now let's take the hedgehog concept and apply it to mindful reviews. Because if you remember, mindful reviews only launched in November. I've been running Mindful Hunter for almost 7 years now. So there were times during that 7 years when I had some of the answers to some of these questions, but I never had answers to all three of these questions until probably last September. And then it took me from September to November to build Mindful Reviews and launch it. So what am I deeply passionate about? I knew this from the outset. The answer was hunting. As soon as I went on my first backcountry hunt, I knew beyond a shadow of a doubt, this was what I wanted to do with the rest of my life. And I wasn't even aware yet that I could potentially turn that into a career or something that I would actually get to focus the majority of my attention on. I knew I had to figure out a way that I would get to do a couple backpack hunts per year, which meant making more money, making more free time, figuring it out with the wife. Like, there was a lot of problems that needed to be solved. But I knew beyond a shadow of a doubt that I was deeply passionate about backcountry hunting. Now, what can you be the best in the world at? Now, this I figured out half of it pretty early on. So when I killed my first backcountry blacktail solo, I remember watching a bunch of YouTube content at the time and thinking to myself, this stuff is trash. It was just terrible. And when I started telling people the story of how I took that deer, I realized, A, people were fascinated with the story. B, the verbal retelling of the story was a poor analog for the intensity of the experience. Like, it wasn't communicating the richness of the experience. And then C, I'd already been making videos for almost 10 years before that. In fact, I started a business making brand videos back in 2010. I think 2010 or 2011, like we're going back 12, 13 years now. I used to work at a gym, a like really high-end personal training gym in Vancouver. And I would make like profiles of the client. I would make videos for the YouTube channel. And that was all on my own time. I had like a little HD camcorder that had those little DV tapes. And I would have to like use RCA cables to plug it into the computer. And then it was like the editing process was insane. Like, so I'd been making videos for a long time already. And I knew that I was good at making videos and telling stories. So when I realized I wanted to tell stories of my hunting, I already had some technical expertise, and looking around at what everybody else was doing. And this is obviously subject to personal opinion. Some people might think my videos are shit. I would disagree, and I'll put my stuff head to head with any of that overproduced kind of stuff that's out there right now or heavily sponsored stuff any day of the week as far as storytelling capability. So I knew that I had the ability for a certain group of people to make videos about hunting that in a way would be the best in the world. Like, they're not going to be the best in the world for everybody, but for a certain group of people, I knew they were going to be better than what was currently available. And that was kind of half of the answer. I'll get to the other half of the answer in the moment. And then, what drives your economic engine? This was the one that I had no idea how to answer. And I think this is probably, for some people, the hardest of the three questions to answer. Now, my wife owns a very successful magazine. She lives in the classical world of advertising. She's very good at what she does. And she could never understand why I just didn't pursue brand deals. And I kept trying to explain to her that brand deals is what's wrong with my industry. At the time, I wasn't even hyper aware that it was a problem with gear reviews, because I was still kind of new in the industry and I hadn't really discovered how bought and paid for all that shit was. But I knew it was a problem in hunt films. I was watching a lot of YouTube content, and you know the guys I'm talking about, and all of their stuff was just one big product placement. And it was just like, I can't even watch that garbage anymore, because it's so in your face that it... So when you're making a film, there's supposed to be a thing called suspension of disbelief. And when you are fully engrossed watching a film or reading a book and you suspend your disbelief, you get wrapped up in the story and you forget that you're watching something. You forget that this was filmed and edited and put together later on, and you are completely captured in the moment. Now, because of the intensity of the product placements, none of these guys ever achieve suspension of disbelief. I am fully aware I am watching one big commercial the whole way. The reason I think I can get away with hour-long sheep hunting films where nothing even dies and I get really powerful engagement and people send me messages that they love the material is because that suspension of disbelief occurs. That complete, you know, engagement with the material occurs. And that's because I'm not pulling you out of it by throwing products in front of your face consistently throughout the telling of the story. And I was trying to explain to her, I don't know how I'm going to make money from this. All I know is that I need to build it bigger. And if I just keep building it and more people pay attention to it, at some point, I'm going to figure out how to create some kind of economic flow from this content that I'm building, because it costs me a lot of time. It costs me a lot of money. You know, it takes away from my other revenue generating activities. Like, it was clear that if I wanted to spend as much time on it as I was, I needed to figure out some way for it to generate some revenue, even just to pay for itself. So we've got question one answered, question two half answered, and question three not answered at all. And it might take you years to answer these questions for yourself. So fast forward, I do hundreds of videos, I experiment with all kinds of things, and I'm going to give you a framework for experimentation in a moment. Actually, let's pause here and talk about that framework. So Jim Collins has another framework called Bullets versus Cannonballs. Now, most people like big bets, and that I want you to think about, you're on one of those old sailing ships and you are in the middle of a big battle, all right? And you've got three cannonballs left on your ship, and the other ship is so far away that there's some doubt as to whether or not you're going to be able to hit this ship with your cannonball perfectly. And you only have two or three cannonballs left, so you're nervous. Now, what would be best? To just stick your cannonball in there and hope for the best? No. What Collins argues is that what you should do is fire a few bullets. Now, a bullet is not a perfect analog for a cannonball. You're going to have to make some inferences and suppositions about, you know, the aerodynamics and the flight trajectory and all that. But if you were to fire a couple bullets, and these are muskets and cannonballs. So the bullets are both round. The bullets and cannonballs are both round. They're both being fired by black powder. They're going to, you know, the same basic rules of physics are going to apply. So yes, one's smaller and lighter, but we can infer some conclusions about bullet trajectory and utilize those to inform how we aim the cannonball. So his argument is, take a couple of bullets, fire a couple bullets in the direction of the other ship, watch their flight, because it's low-risk experimentation. You've got tons of bullets. You're not worried about running out of bullets. Now, you're not going to kill the other ship with the bullets, but you're gaining data that is going to inform future decisions so that you have a higher likelihood of success. So you fire a few bullets, you note some data about the flight trajectory, this informs your cannonball, you line your cannonball up, and boom. And maybe that first one isn't 100% perfect, but it's way better than it would have been without firing the bullets. Now you have one real world example, you tweak the trajectory one more time, fire your last two cannonballs, smoke the other ship, you win the day. Now, when you are considering different either businesses or hobbies or side hustles, what I would urge you to do is look for relatively low risk experiments to find out if there's product market fit for the idea that you have. Okay. So those bullets for me were those YouTube videos. They were cooking videos. They were workout videos. They were review videos. And you get instant feedback, like some blow up and some tank. So now we're left back at the 5 backpack review. Now this is interesting. So that was almost halfway between a bullet and a cannonball. I'd done enough gear reviews by that point. I'd fired enough bullets with cheap gear reviews, stuff that I was already going to buy anyways, you know, and I'm just reviewing the stuff that, you know, I had to buy boots. So I bought boots and then I reviewed those boots. So there's like no risk involved in that at all. I had enough data to be confident that I had an audience for technical reviews, but I'd never done anything as audacious as the 5 backpack review. So I guess in our analogy, that would have been my first cannonball because I took $5,000 of my own money. I had no idea if I was going to be able to make it back. And I bought those 5 backpacks. But it wasn't a rash decision because I knew based on the data I had from firing the previous bullets that I had a high likelihood of success. So I fired that cannonball and it was success. So now I have the second half of the answer to question number 2. What can you be the best in the world at? I can be the best in the world at creating content for a YouTube channel that is essentially 50-50 split between hunting films that are primarily solo hunts and long technical gear reviews. And when I put those two things together, it was the perfect blend of what I was passionate about and what my technical expertise gave me an advantage on with other people because of my background in business, because of my background in tech, because of my background in video creation. I had a suite of skills that not many other people had. Okay, so now we're rolling. Now question number 2 is answered. What about question number 3? What drives your economic engine? You know, and I still owe Cody Rich a debt of gratitude for this one because he's got that the Rich Ideas Lab, which I did join, and they're like I highly recommend if you guys are, you know, contemplating a side hustle and you're looking for other like-minded entrepreneurs, it's a great group to join. But he actually saw the backpack video. He'd already been on the podcast. We're kind of like acquaintances that would like text back and forth because we're both entrepreneurs and we kind of like got along and saw eye to eye on some things. And his original pitch was actually not exactly how it turned out, but it's what got my wheels turning. He actually pitched like some kind of Kickstarter thing. But it I actually misinterpreted his thing into like this membership platform. And then when I went back and checked, he's like, well, it's not exactly what I meant, but it was his initial idea that I want to give him credit for. And then it all started coming together. I was like, well, wait a minute. I could have this website where people could engage with me, help decide what to review. And I should say there's one more missing piece. After I did the backpack review, I did a tent review. And when the tent review was done, I decided to raffle off all of the tents. And that raffle blew up. And that was the last missing piece to the economic engine part. I realized people loved raffles for high-end outdoor gear. And I thought to myself, if I can create a community where you get to participate in raffles, you get to choose what gets reviewed, you get forums that have no trolls because they're behind a paywall, so people aren't going to just, you know, if people have to pay to join, that is an automatic filter to assholes. And I can tell you now that we're at almost 200 members and there's not one single asshole. Every single person that is on Mind for Reviews gives conscientious, thoughtful responses. They participate. It's fantastic. So now I had answers to all three questions. So now I have my personal hedgehog. I'm deeply passionate about backcountry hunting and the gear that is required to do it successfully. I believe I can be the best in the world at making solo backcountry hunting films and long-form technical gear reviews. And my economic engine is an online community platform that enables people to engage with me, choose what to review, participate in raffles, and qualify for free prizes once a month. Boom, that's my hedgehog. That is now based on what I believe my own unique competitive advantages are, which you can pull out of that. Has to do with, you know, some of the skills and the assets that I already mentioned before. Okay, so there's kind of the spiel about competitive advantage and then how to utilize what you know about your competitive advantage to paint a picture about how you could actually, you know, facilitate some type of transition or build something utilizing that competitive advantage. Now, what I want to do is give an example to the opposite. Okay, so we examined Mind for Reviews and how that was a successful application of competitive advantage. Now let's look at something that is the lack of competitive advantage, and that is me competing in bodybuilding. Okay, so the first thing I think when you think you have a competitive advantage, find something that will objectively check your ego or let you run a litmus test on that belief. Because when I started bodybuilding, I did believe I had a competitive advantage because of my discipline. I thought, like, I know I can work harder than people. I know I can stay stricter on a diet than other people. I think that will give me advantage. By competing in bodybuilding shows, forcing myself to say, listen, this is the best I'm personally capable of, and then showing up at those shows and looking at the type of shape that other people were in and the type of muscle other people were able to put on, you have to be a moron to not understand that I have no competitive advantage in bodybuilding. Now, that doesn't mean you can't do it. You can have a hobby that you don't need a competitive advantage to compete in or to participate in. Maybe you like playing soccer and it's just fun. Maybe you like sculpting and you make coffee mugs for your mom. That's one area of your life. But if you're trying to find something that you want to pour your passion, your heart and soul, and you want to drive some form of economic engine in, just being okay is not good enough. And I think that's where a lot of people are losing the plot. They think that just because they're interested in something, they should be able to turn it into a business. And what I'm trying to tell you is, if you don't do your homework to identify and then assess whether you have a competitive advantage, You should not be doing this. Day trading is a perfect example. Like 1% of the world actually makes money day trading. I've studied trading a lot. I trade stocks. I trade crypto. I've done it for years. I don't day trade anything anymore because I realized what you need to have a competitive advantage to day trade and to actually make money is so unbelievably rare that you would have to be a moron. You might as well go buy a lottery ticket. Like if you actually think you're going to win the Lotto 649, that is the same level of delusion as thinking you can day trade successfully. And if somebody, like, please send me a message if you think you're a successful day trader, because I'll burst your bubble. 99% of people who think they are, aren't. By the time you include transaction costs and taxes and, you know, run your, you know, you might have a year or two where it works out for you in a bull market, but like anybody who day trades for longer than 10 years, literally, unless you are that 1%, like, you need to be part of, like, you know, the Bridgewater Group or Renaissance Capital or like one of these insanely powerful, technologically infused organizations. Like those are the only people that are actually making money off of, you know, you can make money from investing. Don't get me wrong. You can make a lot of money from investing, but thinking that you're smarter than the market is a perfect example of a misapplication or a misunderstanding of competitive advantage. If you don't have an edge in trading, you are just rolling the dice. So I thought I had a competitive advantage in bodybuilding, and then I show up after bringing what I can unequivocally say is the best I'm capable of, and the best I'm capable of is seventh place out of 13 dudes. And when you look at the genetics of those dudes in the top three, like I said, there was guys who were 280 pounds, who were the same age as me. Like they were just monsters. And listen, I've done my fair share of gear. Those guys are not just doing more gear than me. I know that for a fact, because if you could just get there by doing more gear, I would have done it. It doesn't work like that. There's a point of diminishing returns with gear. People think that the bigger guys are just taking more juice. I know several, probably more than a dozen IFBB pros on a first name basis, and I've known them for years. I can tell you several cycles that like Olympia caliber pros are on right now, and you would be shocked at how small they are. So it's not just a matter of more gear. But by finding that way to objectively check my assumption about my competitive advantage, I now have to confront that information and be like, okay, I thought I had a competitive advantage here. I don't. Now, what do I do with that information? My ego tells me to keep running it into the ground. Like, I want to be good at this, but then I had to ask myself, like, what is the best case scenario? Like, what if I won the show in Toronto? You know what changes about my life? Nothing. Nothing. Okay. Now, what if I take that same time, energy, and money and pour it in Mind for Reviews, and I can get Mind for Reviews up to 2,000 members over the next 5 years? What changes about my life? Everything. Now I can focus all of my time and attention on hunting and gear reviews. I can quit my day job. I can spend more time with my kid. I can spend more time hunting. Like all of those things. And that's because bodybuilding doesn't check the rest of the boxes. I can't be the best in the world at it. I may be deeply passionate about it, but I can't be the best in the world at it. And there is no economic engine for a 44-year-old middle of the road bodybuilder. And once I was honest, like ruthlessly honest with myself about that, there, if I was about to say it makes the decision easy. It doesn't just make the decision easy. There is no decision. See, that's what frameworks do. They remove from you the responsibility of decision making. Because once you put the data and the evidence in front of you that clearly, there's no decision to be made. Now, I will never give up training. I love training. I like being pretty jacked. I'll be on TRT for the rest of my life. I can walk around at 6'1", 225, 10% body fat. No problem. It doesn't require me to give up or take an undue amount of time and energy away from the other things that I do want to be growing my business at. Okay, so let me back up because I had a couple more points about the actual bodybuilding part. Now, I knew last year that I wasn't going to be a professional bodybuilder. Well, I knew that. I always knew that. But like, I had all of the insights that I just shared with you, I had for my first bodybuilding show. But because I felt like I didn't bring my best, I made a calculated decision that even though I knew it didn't fulfill the concept of the hedgehog, and even though I knew it wasn't going to meaningfully add to my life, for my own personal satisfaction, I needed to run it for one more year. I needed to get to the point where I felt comfortable walking away. Now, the reason I bring that up is that's part of, we're going to segue now into talking about transitions. Because once we've identified where we want to transition to, now we need to identify how to transition. And being psychologically comfortable with the transition is very important. So this may mean, even though you know staying at your day job sucks, you're going to do it for one or two or three more years because it's going to put you in a place financially that will facilitate the transition. Or even if you know you have a behavior like bodybuilding that's not adding to your life, but because you've poured your heart and soul in it, you can't just quit in one day. You may need to outline for yourself, like maybe you're addicted to running and your knees are shit, but you want to run a sub 3-hour Boston marathon. And you're like, listen, I got one more in me and it's going to blow out one of my knees, but so what? I'm going to suck it up because I need that psychologically to feel okay about moving on. That's fine. We just need to be honest with ourselves about the role that's playing and like what it is. You're doing this to be psychologically comfortable with the transition. You're not doing this, and you can't trick yourself when it's done to another one, another one, another one. You have to commit and execute with discipline. So that was okay. I knew what I was doing. I was allowed to do one more. But you can't competitively bodybuild halfway. So there wasn't enough room. And my hunting in 2022 and the first half of 2023 continued to take a hit. I was too heavy for the backcountry. I had to spend too much time working out. There was all kinds of factors that decreased the amount of success I was having hunting. And I had to be honest with myself that I was willing to take that hit in order to accomplish this goal. I accomplished the goal. I brought the package I wanted to bring. Now it's time to move on. So now let's talk about transitions. First and foremost, you need to plan your transition. So I want to tell a little bit of a story. Back when I was working at that gym, Studio 55, first I was a personal trainer, and I was a personal, I don't know, a year or two. I'm not a good personal trainer. Technically, I know everything you need to know, but I'm not good at caring more about you than you care about you. The best personal trainers I met, and I've worked with world-class personal trainers who work with movie stars and shit, they care more about the clients than the clients care about themselves. And that's what a great personal trainer does. They pull more out of you than you know that you have to give. I'm not that guy. I don't care more about you than you care about you. And I'm just honest about that. Like, I'm not built like that. I'm not a highly empathetic individual. And so after doing that for a couple of years, the boss was like, listen, you're good at this. People like you. You're charismatic. You're great to have around the gym, but it's clearly not your calling. Why don't we move you into sales? So I moved into sales. I hate sales. I'm shit at sales. Unless it's in an area that I'm passionate about. Like when it has to do with Mindful Hunter or Mindful Reviews and I'm trying to build members, like that's totally different because I feel like I'm delivering value. I don't feel like I'm convincing you to buy something. So kind of all of a sudden one day I just quit. I gave my 2 weeks notice. I had like a couple $100 in the bank. And I kind of shit the bed, like, but I was single. There wasn't a lot going on. I, you know, rent was pretty affordable. So it was like, it was okay that I floundered. But Nathan, the owner of the studio, is like, he kind of pulled me aside and he's like, listen, man, I know you're going to be fine. But like the next time you do something like this, plan for it. Take 6 months, build up a bankroll. So that when you go to transition into whatever it does, because he's like, listen, man, you're just going to have to take the next thing that comes available because you don't have any type of cushion or war chest to live on while you turn this into what you want to turn it into. And he goes, that's the problem with not planning transitions, is that it's not a transition. It's just stopping one thing and then starting whatever next opportunity becomes available. You are removing the intentionality of the transition. You are removing the opportunity to use the time of the transition to move into something that you love. And that always stuck with me because he was 100% right. And ever since that happened, I've had multiple transitions. You know, I transitioned into my MBA. I quit the engineer. I was running my own consulting company doing forestry for a while. I transitioned out of that and I transitioned into being the general manager for IPSG. And then I quit that job and I started BeThink, the consulting company. But all these other transitions since that one were calculated. And I'd make sure I had a bankroll and I would make sure I had a plan and I would make sure my life was set up and I would just suck up whatever I was doing, even no matter how much I didn't like it, until the appropriate things were in place for me to facilitate the transaction in a mature, successful way. Now, next, be very honest with yourself about your motivation level of the new activity or undertaking or whatever it is. And the best way for you to do this is to look at your behavior, not your intentions, okay? What I find is that most people describe to you what they want to do. And I always look back at them and say, well, what are you doing? Like, because I can tell you what you want by what you have. You know, let's take the gym, for example. People tell me they want to lose 10 pounds and then they have dessert and they don't work out. I reply, you don't want to lose 10 pounds. You want to be a guy who's 10 pounds lighter, that's possible, but you don't want to do the work that it requires to lose that 10 pounds. Because here's the bottom line. If you really wanted it, you'd already be doing it. Like, the question is not motivation, the question is discipline. But there is a level of desire that needs to kickstart that discipline. So if you're concocting this, like, I want to be a photographer and I want to quit my job and be a photographer. Well, how many hours a day do you spend taking pictures? How many edited photos? How many hours a day do you spend editing photos? How often are you uploading to Instagram? How many times are you contacting people to shoot things for free? Like, and if the answers to these questions are not super, super high, and it's like, oh, I take a couple pictures every now and then, I'm like, it's probably not for you then, man. Like, I am obsessed with hunting and gear. Like, if I didn't have a young family at home, I would be in the bush every single waking moment that I possibly could be. Like, I have to stop myself. I'm leaving tomorrow morning. I just got back from Toronto Monday. I took the red eye home. I landed at 2:00 in the morning. I've been home for 3 days and I'm leaving on an overnight trip on Thursday, primarily because I have a kick-ass wife who's like, this is what you want to do. 2023 is the year. Let's kick this shit into gear. But that's my level of discipline and motivation for the competitive advantage that fulfills my hedgehog, that is facilitating my transition. So look at your behavior. Does it align with what you're telling yourself about how you want to spend your time? And the last two tips I'm going to give. Number one, start your side hustle now. When I had the idea for Mindful Reviews, I sat on it for a couple months. And in my head, I was building it out to be this big thing that I needed investment for and that was going to cost all this money. And I needed to like figure out all these solutions to problems before I could actually do it. And I was talking with my business partner and his ignorance about the whole thing was very powerful. And he's like, well, why don't you just start it now? And I'm like, well, we've got this, we've got that. And he goes, dude, you could give it a couple extra hours in the morning, start building the website, just start now. And then when I actually started doing the research and realized what it was going to take financially to get this thing off the ground and how many hours it was going to take in legwork to like build the back end. And I was like, holy shit, I built the whole thing in under 2 weeks for under $500. That's what it cost me to build Mindful Reviews. But because I'd built it up into my head to be this big thing, the grandiosity of the idea was what was stopping me. But when I actually just stopped thinking and started doing, I was way closer to an MVP, a minimum viable product, than I thought I was. And the amount of work that it took to get something that was ready to go to market was surprisingly little. So whatever it is that you think you want to transition into, start it now. Find a way to build a website, find a way to get your first customer, find a way to deliver your first product. Like, just start doing, because that's the only way you're ever going to really know if you have product market fit. And the sooner you start, the sooner it's going to become something that's big enough and strong enough that you can make it your full-time endeavor. And the last tip I'm going to give is, if you're younger, or even if you're older and looking at transitioning to a job, think about, because everybody always wants to say, like, what's the job I can get that will take the least amount of my time so that I can focus it all over here? I would argue you're better off in a high earning job that actually gives you the financial resources to pursue your passions. I just got asked this question on my story the other day. Do you even have a job? Yeah, I have a job, and it's quite lucrative. And the only reason you see me doing all the hunting trips that I do, I spent almost 100 days in the field last year, is because of how lucrative my day job is. And the reason for that is I spent years crafting my skill set. I spent years going back. I have multiple degrees. I built myself into somebody who was worth a pretty high per dollar value. You know, I could charge a lot for the advice that I give to companies. And because of that, I could work fewer hours, make more money, and have more time and resources left to pursue my passions. So if you want to pursue something that's going to cost a lot of money and take a lot of time, instead of looking for a shit job like washing dishes that you don't have to care about so you have the time, I would argue try and find something that is going to create high net worth for you so that you have more resources at your disposal. Like, I don't feel trapped. If I want to buy gear to review it, I just buy it. If I want to plan a trip, I just clear it with my wife. The money's there. Like, and I have that because I decided to pursue a career that was going to be financially lucrative. So I think that's a fundamental part of planning the transition. I feel like we were kind of like all over the place in this thing, but I do feel like there was a good linear train of thought for everything. This is shit that I'm learning about every single day. The one thing that I feel incredibly grateful for in my life is that somehow I have been able to take my hobbies and the things that bring me joy and integrate them into my life where I get to spend an unbelievable amount of time on them. You know, I competed in jiu-jitsu for multiple years. I got to travel all around the place and do that. I got to go to worlds and different states and different, you know, places in BC and compete. And I had a great kind of, you know, and I did that while being the general manager of an engineering firm. You know, and then it turned into hunting while I did bodybuilding. And now I've been able to do two shows and travel to Toronto and do the Toronto Pro and see, you know, the people that I look up to and have them watch me compete. And I get to do, you know, my hunting schedule this year is insane. I have a significant hunt every month from August through February. And I will do that while having a job, while building Mindful Reviews, while raising a family. And the only reason I'm able to do all this stuff is because of all the information that I just shared with you. I have been able to objectively assess where my strengths are, where my competitive advantages are, and then come up with realistic plans for those things to generate revenue. Because the more revenue an activity generates in my life, the more time I can spend on that activity. And my ultimate goal, you know, by the end of this calendar year, is to have Mindful Reviews be my primary source of income, along with a couple of other things that, you know, I do for my wife's company and I still do for my consulting company. But I want like 80% of my life to be Mindful Reviews so that, you know, I am a professional hunter and content creator and video maker and gear reviewer. That's what I want to do with, you know, the next 10 years of my life. I rarely think, probably the next five, I rarely think any more than 5 years into the future, because I think the uncertainty gets so high more than 5 years out that you're kind of wasting your time, you know, making concrete plans. I hope this podcast was successful, or I hope this podcast, I guess if it's successful, it means it had an impact. It means it helps you make a decision. It could be yay or it could be nay, because the real reason for this podcast was me showing up in Toronto, seeing those guys that took those five spots and being like, I will never look like those guys. Doesn't matter how long I train. Doesn't matter how much gear I take. I'm never going to look like that. And I need to just live with that. And if that's the case, what does that mean? And then I was like, oh, competitive advantage, all this other stuff. And I think about hunting and I think about how much I like being solo in the backcountry. And I'm like, there's people who look at me solo in the backcountry and be like, I will never be like that because I don't like being by myself, or I don't have the mountaineering skills, or, and I realized that in one domain, I'm never going to be the best. In this other domain, I might be. If I spend enough time and energy and learn from enough people, I have the potential to be the best, you know, kind of solo hunting content creator, gear review guy, one of the best out there. And I honestly believe that. And I think the success that I've had over the past couple of years kind of backs that up. But it's only through applying these frameworks that I've been able to come to those decisions and then come to peace with those decisions. So I don't want to keep rambling here in circles. I am deeply passionate about this stuff. If this has brought up a bunch of questions for you and there's any way that I can, you know, help answer those questions or be of service in any way, you know that I'm always here for you guys. Jay@mindfulhunter.com. Hit me up on Instagram, mindful_hunter. Leave a comment below this YouTube video if you're watching it on YouTube. If you're listening to it on podcast, shoot me a, you know, a DM or an email. I would love it if you could help spread this podcast. Like, comment, share, subscribe. I would deeply appreciate it. All of that stuff helps, and I really appreciate the help that you guys give me. And until next time, thanks for tuning in.